Have you been here at the festival before? Or were you here when Red, White and Blue was screened?
I was here with Red, White and Blue, which I believe was 2010. So this is my second time to Oldenburg. And I liked it enough to come back, and I guess they liked me enough to invite me back. So I had a great time last time, and I've only been here for a day, but so far, so good.
When I heard that you were doing a biopic on Donald Crowhurst, it struck me as an unusual choice, because usually you're more into the genre movies and horror films and stuff like that. So how did you come to this project?
I was actually asked if I wanted to direct this film. So I have to be honest and say, before I was asked, I did not know who Donald Crowhurst was. And then once I was asked, I read the script, I did some research. You know, there's a documentary about him, I watched that, and it suddenly became very apparent very early on that this is a really fascinating story. And although it's not a genre film, it still has a lot of themes that I find fascinating, which I've kind of explored in a way in my other films. And it's very much about a good man who makes bad choices. And most of my films, whether it's Red, White and Blue, or whether it's my short from ABCs of Death, or even The Living, The Dead, they're about essentially good people who just do bad things. And quite often those things, they just go from bad to worse, which is exactly what happened here. So it's an exploration of that, and it's an investigation into loneliness, isolation, communication, lack of communication, and ultimately, you know, madness.
Nicholas Roeg was also attached to that story for a long time. I heard he wanted to make this movie, but now he's your executive producer. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, Mike Riley, who's the producer of the film, he is producing another film for Nick. And I think at some point I met up with Mike, who I've known for a long time, and we had our meeting, and then he was going off, and I was, you know, just saying, hey, you know, where are you going? What are you up to? And he said, oh, I'm going to meet Nicholas Roeg. And I was like, oh, wow, that's amazing. I love his films. He's pretty much my favorite filmmaker. That's so cool. And then it turned out that Mike knew him reasonably well. So I think at some point soon thereafter, I said to Mike, hey, why don't you, wouldn't it be amazing if we could get Nick to be an executive producer? So Mike thought about it for a while. He liked that idea as well. So he went back to Nick. And it turns out that Nick had actually tried to get this Crowhurst story off the ground in the 70s, and I think in the kind of early 70s, it might have even been after Don't Look Now, I'm not entirely sure, and they got a reasonable amount of the way down the line in getting it made, but in the end, like often happens, the financing fell apart and he moved on to other projects, and in the end he never made that film. But it's something that I guess has always stayed with him, because it's a very, as you know, haunting and tragic story. So I think when Mike went to him, he was, I think, pretty happy to say yes, to be honest.
Looks amazing in parts, because you're going into very much detail in certain shots.
The film is essentially one man on a boat as he goes through these different stages of guilt, optimism, realism, cheating, guilt, madness. And so it's very much a performance, by the actor Justin Salinger, one man. But with that performance, you know, all the things like the logbooks and the instruments that he used to sail around the world, and as you said earlier on, the food, even the toothpaste, you know, all that stuff, because it was the things that surrounded him on a daily basis, was very important for us to get right and actually feature it in the film, because just to make it that visually a bit more interesting, really.
Talking about your main actor, this is one hell of a one-man performance he's doing there.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you liked it. Yeah, I'm Justin is he's a very successful stage actor back in the UK, and over the last few years has been doing more and more TV and more films, and I hadn't worked with him before, and we had an audition, and I think we unanimously chose him, felt he was the right man for the job, and he was an absolute pleasure to work with, and you know, he'd never been sailing before, so it's actually quite funny to think that we were doing this film about a man sailing around the world, and he couldn't sail a boat, he didn't know, you know, how to do it, so he had to do a lot of research, he had to do a crash course in sailing. But he's, you know, he took it all very seriously, and you know, at times we're out physically sailing in a gale force 7 wind, where I think Justin was feeling seasick, but he carried on and sailed through really with flying colors, as we say in England.
There's always music that is very important, at least in all of your movies, I guess, but at least in those two movies we are talking about today, it shows very much so. The choice to let the actress sing certain nostalgic, typically British songs that everyone in Great Britain knows is a deliberate choice. And this is where the film, in my eyes, gets some kind of social and political commentary. Can you tell us a little bit about this choice?
Yeah, very much so. And I think you're right about music. And I love music, and I'm not a musical person, but I love music. I've listened to music really, I guess, from about 12, 13 is when I got into music. And then since then, I've, listened to music every day and go to lots of gigs and all that kind of stuff. And with this film, it's I think it's set in 1969, I think. And it's very much about, it is a very British film. It's a very British story. And that was the kind of end, that was really the end, starting to become the end of the British Empire as such, when things were still, proper and that kind of older British society still existed. But I felt the tale was almost a metaphor for the decline of the British Empire, because it's very much about, a man who's, jolly ho, I'll sail around the world and it'll be great. And many of the things that have happened in British history have just been through dogged determination, maybe a bit of naivety, but we're British, we can do this. This is a tale which obviously backfires, and it's like, I'm British, and I've completely failed. And the music in the film, that those songs that are in it, Jerusalem, I vow to thee, my country, land of hope and glory, they're all songs that, certainly my generation grew up with, maybe at school, quite often at school, singing them, hearing them sung. And they're very evocative of a certain period in time where actually, the national anthem, for example, when you listen to that, you stand up. Or when you sing it, you stand up, and it's very, you respect your queen, and you respect your country, because those are the important things in life, as well as family. And over the years, I think those qualities, as the world has become more globalized, and travelers a lot more kind of pervasive in our society, the kind of identity of each country to a point has become slightly eroded. And for me, I think it was important to have those songs, because certainly for a British audience, it puts you in the mindset of a bygone era.
Another choice, we talk about fashionista in a little bit, but to see this nostalgic kind of a flashback and 70s style, you choose to color it all bright and blue, and it's very washed out colors even. So can you tell us a little bit about this the choice of colors?
Sure. Well, myself and Milton Cam, my DP, we've been shooting films together since, I think, 2004. And we always try to do something a little bit different, just to keep ourselves interested, and keep the audience, on its toes. And I guess, with this film, it's not something, it wasn't the first period film, but it's the first period film that I'd done in the UK. And just looking at some of the footage of Donald Crowhurst, when he was on the boat, he actually was given film, or a 16mm film, so that there is footage of him actually on the boat, and I have a feeling some of it's black and white. I think some of it may be color, but again, it's just it's very, very grainy. It's very home movie kind of thing, and I just thought, given that this is a one man film, I thought the intimacy that kind of film stock gives. There's something very flawed in that film stock, because you can see the hairs, and you can see the dirt, and you can see the grain. And there's something about it that is quite intimate, but it's also, very reminiscent of the past. So for us to, make it more of an effective period piece, rather than, shooting it on a digital camera and making it look all very contemporary, I just thought, why not really go to town and do, try and recreate how it would have been shot if it had been shot then. The film actually gradually gets more and more washed out. So as we go closer and closer to his breakdown, the film becomes almost monochromatic, or certainly just kind of a blue and a white, from having, you know, all the kind of colors that you would normally have. And then towards the end and his breakdown, it just becomes, yeah, just two colors, which I thought again was a very kind of interesting visual way of getting across his breakdown. And then of course, essentially, there's a part in the film towards the end where it goes fairly crazy, and then it goes back to bright colors and goes all over the place just to show his kind of, you know, then mental degeneration, really. But I have to say, you know, it was nice to do a film where it's very straight for a while, and at some point it just goes kind of mad, really. So I think both in terms of the colorization, but also the sound design and the music, you know, I certainly enjoyed doing that.
The other movie that has the same story that's coming out, it's The Mercy by James Marsh with Colin Firth, which are household names. So I was wondering, how did they plan to make two movies on the same subject? How did that come along? And is this more a competition, or is there a connection between those?
I know when Mike, the producer, first approached me, pretty much, you know, once I said I was interested, he said, you know, I just have to be honest and say there is another film which is got Colin Firth in it, which may or may not shoot around the time that we shoot. But he said that film has been in the works for about 6 years. So it seems like it's not going to happen, but you never know. So, and then it turned out that the other film with Colin Firth, you know, had got James Marsh as the director, and they were starting to film it in 2 months' time. And I think we found out that news sometime in February 2015. And at that point, I was a bit depressed because I turned this the Crowhurst down. The other film that I was hoping was going to happen didn't happen. And I was kind of kicking myself. And I think Mike was thinking, you know, damn, that this is it. We've missed our opportunity. And then he actually met up with the financier. And in the end, the financier's like, we don't have the budget that we used to have, but we do have some budget from left over from some other fundraising. He said, if you think you can make it on this lower budget, then let's just go ahead and do it. And so Mike then spoke to me, and I was like, yeah, let's just, you know, let's do it. So in a weird way, the both films are kind of, you know, I think if theirs hadn't happened, I'm not sure if ours in the end would have happened. And then ironically, in the end, our film has been picked up by the same distributor as theirs, Studio Canal, in the UK. So, which is a bit of a shame in a way, but they're a great company. And so I think inevitably they'll be interlinked, and it'll be very interesting to see how, you know, a $20 million pound or dollar film compares, you know, with actually three Oscar winners, compares with our much more kind of, you know, low budget indie kind of more hands on deck kind of film. So I'm really interested to see both, you know, compared to each other, really.
The other film that we're talking about, nobody can take away that story from you because it's your own, Fashionista, of course.
Okay.
At first, I thought those are two completely different movies. But when I saw it, it has your handwriting all over it, from cutting, camera, colors, whatever. And it's also, both movies are about people who are going great lengths to fulfill their obsessions.
Yep.
You talked about this early on. So there is an obvious link between them, but they're a little bit like day and night. So Fashionista has a different color, a different rhythm, but it's clearly to see that's the same director if you see them back to back. So can you tell us a little bit about the ideas behind Fashionista?
Yeah, well Fashionista I shot after Crowhurst, and it was financed by an executive producer who's probably financed, I don't know, five of my films now. And so someone I know and a friend, he had some money which he felt he had available. And I started, I did write one script about consumerism and anti-consumerism and the kind of shallowness of, you know, purchasing stuff which you don't really need. In the end, I just felt the script wasn't that strong. And usually with my scripts, when I give them to people, people go, oh my God, that's amazing. Or they'll go, oh my God, that's rubbish. And with this one, everyone was like, yeah, it's okay. And at some point, I just thought, you know what, it's wrong if I'm going to go and spend a year, 2 years of my life doing something where everyone just says it's okay. And you know, I don't always listen to people, but it felt like there was such a unanimous consensus that in the end, I decided, okay, I don't want to do that. So I changed my outlook and thought, you know, what film do I want to make? And because Nicholas Rogue had executive produced Crowhurst, he's pretty much my favorite ever film director, and I've always been fascinated in how he makes his films and how he structures his films and physically how do you shoot that story and then edit it in that way. And so in my mind, I've always wanted to try and emulate that and try and do my own Nicholas Rogue film. And so having done Crowhurst with him, you know, I went around to his house a few times, you know, we had conversations, he came to a test screening of the film, gave us notes and stuff. So I just thought, you know what, if I'm going to do, in inverted commas, my Nicholas Rogue film, I should do it now, because having just spent some time with him, anything that, you know, I've learned from him is going to be fresh in my mind. So basically, from that, I then decided to take this idea of consumerism, which I knew I wanted to shoot in Austin, because I'd worked on Red, White, and Blue in Austin and had a bunch of people who I consider friends and great collaborators. And so it kind of went from there, really. And then at the same time, I was thinking, you know, who am I going to cast? And it's always hard casting low budget films. And then I thought of Amanda from Red, White, and Blue, who's remained a friend since shooting Red, White, and Blue. And I thought, you know what, she's such an amazing actress and such a great person to work with. Why don't I write something for her? So then I emailed her, and she said, yeah, of course, I'd love to do something again with you. And then all these things were going round and round and round. And I was thinking, you know, what makes Austin? And there's quite a big vintage clothing store, secondhand clothes. So I thought, you know, let's take that. And then that fed into the consumerism thing. And then the thing about obsession and addiction. And then I was thinking, well, why not try and make a film about addiction and film about drugs, but not having them, you know, like proper drugs. So again, not like Christiane F. or Requiem for a Dream, but some other kind of addiction. So it was quite an interesting process of little ideas here and there just forming the whole. Whereas quite often I have, you know, an idea and it just goes from there.
Talking about Amanda Fuller, she really owns this movie. This is one of the most exciting performances from any actress I've seen this year. So this is just fantastic to see.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. And on behalf of Amanda, thank you very much. Yeah, you know, I think she's truly one of the best actresses in of her generation. And you know, it's a pleasure to work with her. And she, you know, she put her heart and soul into that film. She's in pretty much every scene. And it's you know, it was a very exhausting time for all of us, but I think especially for her, because she was pretty much living that character every day. So I think by the end of it, she was completely frazzled. But she's a really dedicated performer, and I guess she understood the role implicitly. And of course, because I know her, I wrote it for her, you know, and I knew what she's able to do, and I know her. You know, how she's able to act and how she's able to emote and how she's able to react. So I think, I guess, you know, a combination of me knowing her and writing it for her and she being an amazing actress. I think it's been really nice to see pretty much every review that I've read has made a point of saying what an amazing job she's done in that film. So, you know, I'm very happy that she's received the kind of, you know, the I suppose plaudits and respect that I feel she absolutely deserves for it.
Talking about the colors here, is a different beast than looking at Crowhurst. It's like you went in the opposite direction. It's all primary colors. It's night. It's modern props. It has a totally different look, and it's very colorful.
Yeah, well, the idea with that is, and the first time in the clothes shop, when she tries on clothes fairly early in the film, maybe after 5 to 10 minutes, she tries on lots of clothes, and there's some kind of noise which is quite kind of xylophony, quite candy, kind of candy-esque kind of sweet music. And I said to the composer, I want the music to be as a young child, a young girl is going into a sweet shop, and everything she sees is really bright and colorful and really exciting, and that's something that we very much, well, I very much transferred into the coloring process, and I have to say, usually with the grading of the film and the coloring, me and Milton, you know, we have an idea and we stick to it. This film, I wasn't quite sure what it was going to be, and the guy who is the colorist, his guy called Bradley Greer, and we used him or worked with him on one of my previous films, Johnny Frank Garrett, and we got him to do the coloring on this film, and basically you shoot the film and then you go into the edit suite and you change the colors, and usually you change them subtly. But he gave us many different options, and one of the options was this kind of much more blown out, as you say, primary colors really pushed to extremes of saturation, and when I saw that, and this is after we'd edited the film, so quite late in the process, I saw one of the examples that he'd offered, and I just thought, hang on, that looks like the kind of black and white film stock that they've then colored in. For some reason, that just kind of made sense of this film. Again, there's something, you know, nostalgic about the clothing aspect of the vintage stores. Very nostalgic, very old fashioned, and glamorous as well. And so I thought then doing coloring it in that way kind of really made sense for the psychology of the film, that it, you know, all these clothes are really shiny and beautiful and very alluring. So again, you know, I try to use as many tools as possible in the filmmaking process to tell the story, and coloring and grading and the cinematography is one that, you know often you see films and everyone goes, oh, beautiful cinematography, isn't that fantastic, and which of course it is, but with what I've done, I've tried to push, you know, what coloring does to, again, the psychological understanding of a film. So I don't think you'll look at either of these films and go, wow, how elegant, how beautiful, but they have their own style, which I think works very, you know, well, uniquely for their story, really.
The soundtrack is important. You talked a little bit about it. Can you tell us about the music choices? Because there is a lot of music and a lot of great music in that movie.
Yeah. Well, thank you again. Again, you know, going back to the beginning of the interview, I love music, and I've always wanted to have more music in my films, and because Austin is such a kind of melting pot of music, you go there and it's, you know, there's country, you know, there's rock, there's punk, there's metal, there's jazz, there's pretty much anything you can think of. So if you've been to Austin, know Austin and understand Austin, you know, that's kind of mixture of music just feels quite natural. So I wanted to get that across in the film, because I feel that's as important an aspect of Austin and as anything else, really, the music. So I wasn't quite sure how we were going to do it, and then I stumbled across something called Bandcamp. I suppose it's probably best described as an iTunes for unsigned bands. And there are signed bands on it, and there are record labels who put their artists on it. But essentially, you can go onto Bandcamp and find any music that you want. One of the functions of it is you can discover music by cities. So, for example, if I wanted to do a German film, I could put in Oldenburg and see if there's any music coming up for Oldenburg, or I could put in Berlin, or, you know, wherever else. So I put in Austin, and suddenly, I you know, about, I don't know how much, but, you know, let's say 10,000 different, you know, groups came up, and so basically what I did, and this is at the very early process of me being in Austin. So really what I did was I literally every day for half an hour or so, I went through, randomly went through songs on Bandcamp from groups from Austin, and then once I've done that, Then I contacted the bands directly and said, hey, you know, we've got a low budget film. We don't have much money, but we've got a bit of money. Would you be interested in having your song in the film? And I think out of all the bands we contacted, I think two said no, and everyone else said yes. Bandcamp was an amazing resource for me as a as an independent filmmaker, and it's it was a great tool, and it was amazing to be able to source such varied music, and really just fill the film with as much music as I wanted.
There's a central piece of music in it, and we played it on the radio. It's a song by a cowboy and Indian from the UK, where you already provided the lyrics. That's what they told me. This is a great track.
Hey, fantastic. They're friends of mine, and they did a couple of the tracks in my ABCs of Death short film set in a nightclub in Suriname. And again, everything else was found on Bandcamp, but we were lacking a dance kind of club song, and the one song that we had in the edit, the musicians didn't want to give it to us, so we're like, okay, fair enough, and we're running out of time, so I went back to my friends, a cowboy and Indian, and asked them, you know, would they be up for doing another piece of music? So they said yes, and then I can't remember how I came up with the idea that I would do the lyrics, but I was actually in Zagreb for a film festival there with one of my previous films, Johnny Frank Garrett's Last Word, and I was walking around, and as sometimes happens, I wasn't really thinking of anything, and the lyrics just came to me, and I was literally they came to me, and I started writing them down on my phone, and then I stopped walking, and then 5 minutes later I'd come up with the lyrics, I think they changed them a little bit, but it was I wanted them to be kind of, again, not too obvious, but still kind of thematic, really. So then they took the lyrics, and Adil did the vocals, and then they did the rest of the song. But yeah, so that was quite exciting, actually. It's the first time I've ever had lyrics in a song before.